just to pick up where David left off, in the 1940s, I was a Zionist youth leader, activist, and advocating exactly the same, pretty much the same positions. This is pre-48, with groups advocating a binationalist solution for the Arab-Israeli conflict. I was part of radical groups. We wanted a solution based on Arab-Jewish cooperation, working-class cooperation, collective institutions, and so on. And I still think that's the right idea, and maybe someday we can get to it, so I don't think it's lost. I think it's delayed. But I'll talk about that. There are plenty of problems in the world for which it's extremely hard to even conjure up a solution. They're just too complex. And there are others that vary in complexity and difficulty. Some of them are actually pretty easy. And the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is one of the easiest of all, because there is a short-term solution, which is agreed upon by essentially everyone. Accepted by the non-aligned countries, most of the countries of the world, by Europe, by the Arab League, by the Organization of Islamic States, which includes Iran. It's accepted by Hamas, the elected government of Palestine. In fact, it's universal. It's also accepted by international law. And that's quite clear, a series of Security Council resolutions, judgment of the World Court, with the U.S. Justice agreeing on the crucial element in a separate declaration. That's a degree of unanimity that's pretty hard to approach, but it isn't implemented. And it isn't implemented because there are two rejectionist states, the United States and Israel, which for the past 35 years have prevented the implementation of an overwhelming international consensus on a short-term solution. It's not the solution that David and I want to see, but I think it's the only possible step towards it, and it's a short-term solution. So the two states, the rejectionist states, are the United States and Israel. Israel's rejection of it is understandable. They'll continue to do so as long as the global superpower endorses, authorizes, and supports it. Now, I'll be talking about Israeli policies here, but when I say Israel, you should hear U.S. Israel. Israel can do essentially nothing without U.S. decisive, U.S. military, economic, diplomatic, and ideological support. The ideological support is creation of a kind of an image underlies the continued rejectionist stand. Actually, we see that today in the front page of every newspaper. There are supposed to be negotiations going on with the U.S. presented as the honest broker, trying to bring together the two recalcitrant opponents who can't get together. In a free society, people would laugh at this. I mean, if there were serious negotiations, there would be some neutral arbiter, you know, maybe from Mars or something, and there would be two sides. One would be the world, and the other side would be the United States and Israel. And the two of them would have to come to terms, because that's exactly where the line has been drawn now for roughly 35 years. The basic elements of that solution are not really in any contention. It would be a settlement on the internationally recognized border, that's the pre-June 67 border called the Green Line, with, quote the official wording, with minor and mutual modifications. That official wording is the official U.S. policy from 1967 to 1971, when the United States was still part of the world. It separated itself at that point. But that was the official wording. It makes sense. The green line is a ceasefire line, so you know, you straighten borders, things like that, and maybe some kinds of land swaps and so on. There are other questions. So, for example, take the question, the allegedly contested question of Jerusalem, which again is on the front pages every day. Just today, with the new programs of building there, that's contested in exactly the same way. The entire world and international law on one side, the U.S. and Israel on the other side. In this case, it's not just Israel's actions, and again, remember, when I say Israel, you hear U.S.-Israel. U.S.-Israel actions in Jerusalem are doubly illegal. They're in violation of international law. Even Israel recognized this 40 years ago. And they're also in strict violation of a series of Security Council resolutions, flatly rejecting them over and over again. You can, now that you have the internet, you look up UN resolutions concerning Israel, you get a long list of them. The crucial issue is the Geneva Conventions, which were established to criminalize Nazi actions, remember. That was what the Geneva Conventions were for, and they, among other things, made it a criminal action to change the legal, physical, demographic characteristics of any area under military occupation. That was directed against the Nazis, who had tried to do that in a hideous fashion, which you all know about. Well, the Geneva Conventions apply to the occupied territories. That's been established over and over again by all the, accepted by all the countries I mentioned. It's repeatedly endorsed by the Security Council of the United Nations, the highest extra-legal authority, and by the International Court of Justice, unanimously. And in fact, Israel itself accepted this back in late 1967, right after the conquest of the territories, when the settlement programs were barely beginning. Israel's leading legal advisor, highly respected international lawyer, Theodor Meron, now on the international justice courts and so on, criminal courts. He was the legal advisor, he advised the government of Israel that any actions taken in the occupied territories were just in violation of fundamental international law. Israel's Attorney General, Shapiro, he agreed with this. Perhaps more interestingly, Moshe Dayan, who was the defense minister and in charge of the occupied territories, and one of the more dovish figures in the Israeli establishment, he agreed too. He said, yes, everything we're planning to do in the occupied territories and beginning to do is in violation of international law, but other countries have violated international law, so we'll do it too. And in fact, they can do it as long as the United States agrees. The United States actually endorsed those resolutions, but quietly said, don't worry about it. And that continues today. So the actions in Jerusalem, which are on the front pages, that's a double violation of fundamental international law. And the actions in the rest of the occupied territories, both the West Bank and Gaza, and of course the Golan Heights, which nobody talks about, but that's the subject of separate resolutions by the Security Council, also in gross violation of international law and international opinion, with the exception of the two rejectionist states. And since the U.S. is a very powerful state, it can dismiss international law and international opinion, as it does not only in this case, but on many other cases, important topic in itself. Well, that means for those of you here who are American citizens, you're responsible for everything that's going on there. If there's a criminal act undertaken by the Israeli government, you're involved in a criminal act. Without that direct support, it can't continue. And the U.S. can, of course, determined that it will end easily. In fact, it's done it in a number of cases where Israeli actions conflicted with U.S. desires. Now, that much is pretty clear. So there is a solution, short-term solution. We know what it is. The thing that's blocking it is the United States and its Israeli ally. I think that's, just don't take my word for it. Just take a look at the record. It's pretty clear, it's basically uncontroversial. You can decide you don't like it, that's okay, it's different, but then say so. Be like Moshe Dayan. Say, well, we know it's illegal and criminal, but we're going to do it anyway, because we have the international godfather on our side. So that's an honest approach towards supporting the actions that are taking place in the occupied territories. And if you want to support them, that's the position you should take. Well, just a few words about the history. I'll, of course, skim the surface. So there's plenty of detail that's not added. If you'd like, we can go into it more in the discussion. 1960, we're talking about the occupation, so we begin in 1967. There's deeper questions, but those are on the side for the purposes of this discussion. June 1967, Israel conquered what are now the occupied territories, the West Bank, Gaza, Golan Heights. The immediate aftermath I've just described in the legal system. Shortly after that, settlement began. At that time, there was rejectionism on all sides. Nobody was talking about a settlement. That changed in 1971. A very important event, which has kind of been whitewashed out of official history, that's part of the ideological support for the U.S.-Israeli actions. But it happened, and it's important. In fact, I think it's one of the most important events in Israel's history. In February 1971, President Sadat of Egypt offered Israel a full peace treaty, nothing for the Palestinians. The Palestinians at that time were considered only refugees, no issue of Palestinian national rights. In return, he called for Israeli withdrawal from, he said, the occupied territories, but all he cared about was Sinai, Egyptian Sinai. That became very clear a year later when Jordan made the same offer. It said, yes, full peace treaty if you withdraw from the Jordanian, the territories that Jordan had held before the 67 war. So Israel at that point had an extremely significant choice. It could have had full security. With Egypt out of the conflict, there's no more military threat. Egypt was the only substantial Arab military force. With Jordan out of the conflict too, the next year that sort of ends it. It gets about as much security as any state can hope to have. So they had a chance for full security, but at the cost of expansion. They had to make a choice between expansion and security. Very clear choice. At that point, the expansion was mostly into the Sinai. We've sort of forgotten that now. But at that point, the Labor government, Golda Meir's government, was beginning to initiate large-scale development projects in the northeast Sinai. They were planning to establish a huge city, a city of 1 million people, Yamit, on the Mediterranean, and a series of settlements, including kibbutzim, all over that region of the north of the Egyptian Sinai. In preparation for that, the Israeli army had brutally expelled the people who were living there, Bedouins. You think of Bedouins as people wandering around. No, they had towns, settled communities, agricultural areas. They were simply forcefully driven into the desert and in preparation for these building projects. And that's what Sadat had in mind. He said, well, if you withdraw from these regions, then you can have full peace. So Israel had to make a decision. Do we want expansion, mostly into the Sinai, or do we want security, which we can have right now? And they decided on expansion. I think that's the most fateful decision in Israel's history. Once you've decided on expansion rather than security, it follows you're going to have perpetual conflict. And it also follows that they're going to have to rely on superpower protection. So that's when the definitive reliance of Israel on the United States began. The crucial question at that time was, how's the United States going to react? That's always the crucial question in international affairs because of its power, and crucially in this case. There was a debate. There was an internal debate in Washington. The State Department was in favor of accepting Sadat's offer, which in fact was pretty much in line, almost entirely in line, with official U.S. policy. Henry Kissinger was the National Security Advisor, and he was opposed to it. Chances are he was opposed to it because his prime enemy in the world was the State Department. The Russians were down somewhere below. He was desperately eager to take over the State Department, which he finally did. So William Rogers, Secretary of State, was his main enemy in the world. He writes about this in his memoirs, but what he says is so utterly ridiculous that it's almost inconceivable that he believed it. American scholarship is very kind. They avoid this, the huge scholarship about Kissinger. I can go into the details if you want. Actually, I used to use it in undergraduate classes at MIT, just reading the memoirs, but it was impossible. The students are just rolling on the floors. But his position was that he was in favor of what he called stalemate, meaning no negotiations, just force. Okay, so reject Sadat's offer. Well, he won out on the internal conflict. There was a stalemate. No rejection of Sadat's offer was rejected. Egypt made very clear that they were serious about it. Sadat kept announcing as loudly as he could, Yamit means war. If you're going to build in the northeast Sinai, there's going to be a war. He expelled the Russian advisors to try to sort of show Kissinger that, look, we really mean it. The United States and Israel simply disregarded him. It was a period of extreme triumphalism, particularly in Israel. They were very sorry about it later, and in fact wrote about it. But if you look at the period, it was one of extreme triumphalism. The Arabs don't know which end of the gun to hold, you know, we'll do what we like, and so on. An interesting book about it by an Israeli journalist, which I tried hard to get somebody in the United States to publish in English, but no hope. If you can read French, you can read it in French. I'm not Capelio. It was quite basically triumphalist. We can disregard the Arabs. And Kissinger had the same view. He understood the mailed fist. He said, we got the force, they can't do anything. Well, they did something. In October 1973, there was a war, and Israel came very close to destruction. It was the worst moment in its history. At that point, they barely escaped, thanks to enormous U.S. aid at the end. At that point, the clouds lifted. Kissinger and the Israelis recognized that the Arabs know which end of the gun to hold. We can't simply regard them as Egypt as a basket case. So therefore, we better get involved in negotiations. And then starts Kissinger's famous shuttle diplomacy, you know, the master negotiator going up and back between Israel and Egypt. All of this is just farce. I mean, there was a proposal on the table already, but you had to make it look as if the United States was achieving a diplomatic settlement. Well, that's the way history is written. At Camp David, because the victors are powerful, are the ones who write history, but you can find out the truth if you like. It's all quite open in the documentary record. There were meetings in Camp David in 1978 under Carter where effectively Israel and Egypt accepted Sadat's 1971 offer. Now, an honest history would say that that was a diplomatic catastrophe. They accepted the offer that they rejected in 1971 at the cost of a major war, came close to a nuclear war, virtual destruction of Israel, vast suffering. But finally, the United States and Israel accepted what they'd rejected in 1971. But it's called a diplomatic triumph, because we write history to make what we do look wonderful. That's a principle of academic scholarship if you really want to make it in the field. But the facts are quite plain. In fact, it's even worse than what I said. The agreement that President Carter and it was then Menachem Begin, Prime Minister, what they agreed to in 1978-79 was actually worse from their point of view than what Sadat had offered in 1971. Because in the interim, in the 1970s, the issue of Palestinian rights had entered the international agenda. It hadn't been there in 1971. You look at the major diplomatic documents, like famous UN 242, there's nothing for the Palestinians. Sadat's offer, nothing. Jordan's offer the year later ignored the Palestinians. But by the mid-70s, that was not possible anymore. The Palestinian issue had come front and center. Palestinian rights were beginning to be recognized. And in fact, in January 1976, next crucially important date, also wiped out of history. Things that are important tend to get wiped out of history if they don't sound right. January 1976, there was a resolution brought to the UN Security Council by the major Arab states, by Egypt, Syria, Jordan, so-called confrontation states. It called for a two-state settlement on the international border, essentially the international consensus. It included all of the crucial wording of UN 242. Those of you who know the history know that it's agreed on all sides that UN 242 is the basic document. It called for recognition of the rights of all states in the region to exist in peace and security within secure and recognized borders and other similar wording. All of that was incorporated in the January 1976 resolution. The one difference was that they now called for a Palestinian state in the occupied territories. That was the difference. And in the United States vetoed the resolution. When the U.S. vetoes a resolution, it's actually a double veto. One, it's not implemented. Two, it's eliminated from history. That's ideological power. That's what you go to universities to learn how to do. It's not a joke, incidentally. But not my original comment. Orwell talked about it many years earlier. But it's wiped out of history. The same thing happened in 1980 under Carter. Similar resolution, same veto. Meanwhile, things didn't disappear on the ground. I won't run through the rest of it. And in 1978-79, the residue of that remained. So the agreement that Begin and Carter had to accept had some reference to Palestinian national rights, vague, unspecific reference, but at least something. Whereas Sadat's offer in 1971, the Jordanian offer a year later, said nothing. Palestinians had no rights, just refugees. That's the diplomatic catastrophe of 1978, down in history as a diplomatic triumph. I won't run through the rest of the history, but if you want to look, it's quite interesting. Year after, since the Security Council was eliminated because of the U.S. vetoes, the issue moved to the General Assembly. And year after year, there were resolutions at the General Assembly, you know, with votes like 150-3 or something. Sometimes the United States picked up a Pacific island or, you know, some Central American state or something like that, but essentially universal. Incidentally, this is not the only case. This is the case on many issues. And those who are concerned about their own country, if you're American citizens, ought to be aware of this. So just to take an example in another part of the world, a couple of weeks ago, the General Assembly passed its annual resolution condemning the U.S. embargo on Cuba. This year, the vote was 190-2, the United States and Israel. Now, the year before, it had been 189-3. The United States had Palau that year. If you go back occasionally, and the votes on the occupied territories are approximately the same. Sometimes, for example, in 2008, there was a vote on control of arms sales, and a General Assembly vote on that, I forget the high number, but there were two states in opposition. At that time, even Israel didn't go along with the United States. The only state that went along was Zimbabwe. Well, that's obviously unreportable, so if you check the record, you'll find nothing about it. But that happens pretty consistently. U.S. policy towards Israel is not that unusual. And it has to do with the policies of world domination, being the status of world domination. You've got a lot of people opposed to what you do. But in the case of Israel-Palestine, I'll keep to that, the votes are pretty much the same, straight through. That's the record of rejectionism that continues until today. Now, there have been a couple of breaks, and they're worth understanding, because they give you an indication of what can be done if a U.S. government was willing to join the world. That's the crucial issue, in my opinion. The one significant break was in January 2001. In the year 2000, there were negotiations at Camp David, famous negotiations. They broke down. The media and commentary blame it on the Palestinians. Clinton knew better, however. He was the president. He recognized that the U.S.-Israeli proposals at Camp David could not be accepted by any Palestinians. And in December of 2000, he revised them. He issued what he called his parameters for a settlement. The parameters were kind of vague, but they were more forthcoming. Then he, a couple of days later, he made a speech in which he said, both sides have accepted the parameters, both sides have reservations. They then met in Taba, Egypt, to try to iron out their reservations, high-level negotiators of Israel and Palestine. And we have a lot of information about that. Unfortunately, we have no information from the Palestinian side. That's a lack that goes way back. But we have a lot of information from a very respected international observer, the European Union observer, now Prime Minister of Spain, Martinez. He gave a lengthy account of it. He was present. And we have a ton of information from the Israeli side. A lot of it, unfortunately, is in Hebrew, but some is in English, and from other observers. And they coincide. The pictures coincide. They were coming very close to a solution. In fact, in their final press conference around mid-January, the two sides had a joint press conference, and they stated that with a few more days they might iron out everything. There were still some points of disagreement, not trivial ones, but the major issues had, there was at least a basis for settlement, something pretty close to settlement, and they thought they could go on to a full settlement. Well, at that point, the Israeli Prime Minister, Barak, terminated the negotiations prematurely, and that was the end of that, almost. That was the end of formal negotiations. But informal ones continued, again at a high level, high-level officials and figures on both sides. And they came out with a very detailed proposal. It's called the Geneva Accords, because it was presented publicly at Geneva in December 2003, and that dealt with lots of details. That was agreed by both sides. You can like it or not, I'm just describing what happened, whatever one's opinion is toward that agreement. Well, it was released in Geneva. It's in print. You can find it. It's in English. There's a lot of stuff about it. It was released in Geneva in December 2003. It was welcomed by most of the world. You know, government sent representatives and so on. Israel flatly rejected it. The United States disregarded it. So if you look at the commentary here, almost nothing. You know, maybe you find a small news item somewhere. Well, that's the double veto again. When the U.S. rejects something, it doesn't happen, and it's wiped out of history. Except for people who want to understand history. For them, it's not wiped out. A lot of things have happened since in the last decade, but my own view is that nothing that's happened makes that outcome impossible. It may make it harder, but I don't think it makes it impossible. So in my view, at least, this possibility is still an open one. It's possible to implement the position of the entire world, aside from the rejectionist states, and international law, maybe with some modification because of what's happened since. Well, that's about where we stand now. The question is, what are the options? What can we do about it? And we means people here. This is ultimately a decision for citizens of the United States. We have the decisive vote on this. It's not something that people are, you know, recalcitrant opponents are arguing about out there. It's right here. There are several options. One option is the overwhelming international consensus accepted by essentially everyone and explicitly in accord with international law, World Court, Security Council resolutions, and so on. So, for example, when you read in the papers that much of the world doesn't accept the legitimacy of the Israeli occupation, it's kind of an understatement. That means the entire world outside of the United States and Israel. That's the way you have to read that. You know, maybe you can find somebody in Costa Rica who doesn't agree, but essentially that's what I said is correct. But so one possibility is that the rejectionist states will change their position. Now, Israel's not going to change its position as long as the United States supports it. The countries don't give things up. You know, they don't need it for security. In fact, it harms their security. It's pretty much recognized. But as the head of the Israeli Air Force, Cesar Weizmann, later president, as he explained back in 1970, we don't want the occupied territories don't contribute to our security. In fact, they probably harm. But without them, we can't live at the scale and quality and power that we desire, words approximately to that effect. And that's essentially the point. As long as the United States backs it up, it'll continue. And the United States is backing it up. So, for example, right now there's supposed to be a conflict between Obama and Netanyahu over settlement expansion. Actually, there's not much of a conflict. If you look at Obama's wording or Clinton's wording, it's extremely mild. Netanyahu, on the other hand, is very brazen and arrogant and has every right to be. He says, look, we're going to go ahead and do it. We don't care what you think or what the world thinks. And he's right. Obama has already made it clear to him that the United States is going to continue to support the expansion of the settlements. So why shouldn't he say it? You know, he's being criticized, but I don't see any basis for criticism. Maybe he shouldn't be that brazen. Maybe he shouldn't, you know, flaunt his arrogance in Obama's face or something. Okay, bad tactics. But basically, he's correct. Obama, when he came into office, was asked, he made a big, a lot of talk about how he's going to settle the Israel-Palestine problem. And he said at the time, well, we're opposed to expansion of the settlements. We want to keep to what's called the roadmap. And the roadmap was an agreement of four partners, United States, Europe, Russia, and the United Nations. It's a quartet. They agreed a couple of years ago on what they called a roadmap for settlement of the issue. And the first step was no expansion of settlements, no natural growth, no nothing. So Obama was simply saying, okay, I endorse what the four participants laid down as the roadmap. One of the charges against Hamas is that they don't accept the roadmap. Whether they do or not, we could debate, but it's an interesting charge because the U.S. and Israel immediately rejected it. Israel technically accepted it. This is Prime Minister Sharon, but they immediately added 14 reservations, which completely undermined it. Now, the media here were polite enough not to report this. Activists knew it. You could hear it in talks, but it broke through to the public, or almost did, in former President Carter's book, Israel, and what's called Peace or Apartheid. In that book, for the first time in the mainstream, the reservations were articulated, and in fact, to make sure nobody would miss it, there's an appendix which lists them. Now, if you read them, you see that they simply undermine the roadmap, that the United States essentially accepted them. It's kind of intriguing that Carter's book elicited a huge furor and much discussion right here as well. But I've never seen a reference to the one new fact that was brought up in his book, not new to people who've been following closely, but new to the public. See if you can find one.
But it's there. So Israel and the United States immediately
rejected the roadmap. And when Obama came in and said, well, I'd like to keep to the roadmap, he was immediately asked in a press conference, his spokespeople were asked, what are you going to do about it if Israel continues to expand the settlements? And the answer was nothing. He was then asked, well, this is only symbolic, they said. He was asked, are you going to do what President George Bush number one did? You may remember in 1991, George Bush number one and James Baker, Secretary of State, who were kind of patricians, they don't like to be insulted, they were pretty upset by the fact that Israel was purposely insulting them. So when James Baker would go to Israel, you know, as soon as he'd land, the Prime Minister, Shamir, would publicly announce, we're starting a new settlement, just saying, I won't repeat the words, but you know what they are. And Baker didn't like it. He didn't like to insult it to his face. And Bush didn't like it. So they imposed a penalty, a pretty mild penalty, but they said they would withhold loan guarantees at the scale that Israel was using to expand settlements. It was a mild penalty, but real. And Israel immediately backed down, as they always do. They don't confront U.S. power. Not that crazy. So they changed from Shamir to Peres. Peres is more westernized. He understands the norms of Western hypocrisy. That's why he's considered a wonderful diplomat. When Baker showed up, he didn't announce a settlement that day. He said, yes, Mr. Baker, we agree, no more settlements. And 2 weeks later, they started the settlement, which is fine for Bush and Baker. They didn't care, just didn't want to be insulted. They didn't oppose the policies. This continued during the Bush 1 years, when Clinton came in, he essentially backed off from it. He didn't drop the policy, but he gave Israel the authority to determine the expenses that were being devoted to settlement expansion. You can imagine what the results of that were. It elicited considerable ridicule in the Israeli press, properly. But that essentially ended it. When Obama was asked whether he would do anything like that, he said no. His spokesperson said no. What we're doing is only symbolic, which is telling Prime Minister Netanyahu, go ahead and do what you like. Essentially what it amounts to. So when he insults Obama to his face, as they just did a couple of days ago, he has some justice on his side. That's what Obama essentially told him to do, and he's doing it. And we should bear in mind that settlement expansion is a footnote anyway. The issue is not settlement expansion, it's the settlement. That's the issue. Expansion, of course, is illegal too, but the settlements themselves are illegal for the reasons I mentioned. Well, what are the options today for us? One option is that U.S. policy will change, as it did briefly in Taba and then return to the norm. The U.S. will abandon its rejectionist stand, join the rest of the world in calling for the settlement that's, you know, you can debate details, but the basic outlines of it are pretty clear, not controversial, have been for 35 years. That's one possibility. It's commonly argued that that's now impossible. I suspect that Diana, who was here a couple days ago, probably said that, and it's very widely held. They say the project of settlement has gone so far that this is impossible. Personally, I don't believe it. I think that there are simple ways to implement it, talk about them if you like. But bear in mind that if that's impossible, then it follows that any political settlement is impossible because there's no real alternative to this. It's held that there is an alternative. If you follow the debates on this issue, you'll see that among Palestinians and among supporters of the Palestinians, it's commonly proposed that Israel should take over the whole of former Palestine, the entire West Bank, and I'll come back to Gaza, the entire West Bank, as one Palestinian high negotiator, Nuseba, said, we'll give Israel the key. They can take the whole thing. And then we'll carry out a civil rights struggle, an anti-apartheid struggle, like South Africa. Maybe we can win that one. That's a completely academic proposal. There's no reason in the world why Israel would ever accept it. They don't want to be, that they don't want the Palestinians. And they have an alternative. These are not the two alternatives. There's a third alternative. The third alternative is what the U.S. and Israel are in fact doing. They can continue with that. And what they're doing is not obscure. See, right on the ground, if you happen to be there, you can read about it if you want. The details are quite plain. They're essentially implementing a plan which has a lot of antecedents, but it's now pretty much identified with Ariel Sharon, called the Sharon Plan. It was later made explicit by his successor, Ehud Olmert, Prime Minister, who called it convergence. He actually presented it to Congress in 2006 to standing ovation. Convergence, Sharon Plan, means that Israel takes everything within, behind the what's called the separation wall. It's actually an annexation wall, which cuts through Palestinian territory, puts a lot on the Israeli side, and it's not just the quantity, it's also the quality. What it puts on the Israeli side are, first of all, the pleasant suburbs of Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, which of course Israel would like to keep. It includes arable land, some of the most important arable land, and crucially it includes the water resources for the region. Israel already exploits most of the water west of the Jordan, but this includes the main aquifer. So it, everything behind the annexation wall will be annexed. It includes Greater Jerusalem. There's something called Jerusalem, but that's not anything like what Jerusalem ever was. It's many times the size of Jerusalem. Jerusalem, the actual Jerusalem, was annexed illegally over the, in violation of orders of the Security Council, repeated orders. But then it was greatly expanded. So what's called Jerusalem goes well into Judea. I think it's maybe five times or so the original area, roughly that. What's the debate right now about Har Choma, you know, the new settlements, that's an expanded Jerusalem. It's never Jerusalem. So it includes expanded Jerusalem, takes, cuts off a big piece of the West Bank. It includes the Jordan Valley, which means everything else is imprisoned. The Jordan Valley is being settled, and Palestinians are being driven out of it by the usual means, you know, denying them the possibility of access to water, rejecting an effort to build a school, and so on. Usual quiet means of essentially ethnic cleansing. So it includes the Jordan Valley, a big piece of the West Bank, again, arable land, and leaves the rest imprisoned. And then, in addition to that, there are salients cutting through. There's one east of Jerusalem, which goes virtually to Jericho, essentially bisects the West Bank, includes the town of Ma'ale Adumim, big town established in the 1970s, but developed primarily under Clinton, essentially cuts the West Bank in half. And in the northern part of the West Bank, there are two other salients, one going through the town of Ariel, a new town in the West Bank, of course, all of this illegal, and another one that goes through Kedumim. It breaks up the remaining region into unviable cantons. Now, Israel has made, let me say a word about Gaza at this point. Ever since, by the 1980s, Israel recognized that it's a mistake to try to hold on to Gaza. It had already been virtually destroyed under the occupation. It was unlivable. It was just a nuisance. Not much point keeping it so that people from Tel Aviv can go to the beach on Sunday. Oslo agreements, the Oslo agreements in 1993 established that Gaza and the West Bank are an indissoluble unit, one territorial unit. So any crime that's carried out in the West Bank, it's perfectly legitimate to resist it in Gaza. They're one unit. But Israel and the United States have been dedicated, since it's almost 20 years now, to separate Gaza from the West Bank. Now that continues the imprisonment of the, quite apart from what it means for people in Gaza, it continues the imprisonment of the West Bank because it loses its outlet to the sea. And you know, now it's really imprisoned. Of course, it's totally illegal. It means that, as I say, if a person in Gaza is, needs medical assistance that they could get in a Palestinian hospital in East Jerusalem, they have to go through the Israeli authorities. By now, they also have to go through Palestinian Authority and Hamas authorities, who are bad enough in their own ways. But that means you can't get medical treatment, you can't get medicines in, you can't go to school if you happen to be a student who lives in Gaza and studies in Beer Sheva in the West Bank, you can't get there and so on. The idea is to break them apart, two separate entities. The plan for Gaza is just to destroy it. Say a little bit, since I'm talking about the history, about what happened in Gaza. In Gaza, repression was pretty bitter, but it became much worse. Israel did finally withdraw a few thousand settlers from Gaza. That was a great phenomenon. You looked at the Boston Globe, you had front page pictures of a little boy pleading with the soldiers, don't destroy my house, cries of never again, and so on and so forth. That was the great event of withdrawal from Gaza. It was all staged, completely staged, for international attention. If Israel wanted to withdraw from Gaza, they could have done it very simply. All they had to do was announce on August 1st, that the IDF, the army, is withdrawing from Gaza. At that point, the 7,000 or 8,000 settlers who were there illegally in subsidized homes would climb into the lorries that are provided to them and be taken to their subsidized homes illegally in the West Bank. And it wouldn't have made the front page of the Boston Globe. In fact, nobody would even notice. But that's just the point. The point was to stage a national trauma. This was so transparent that it was being ridiculed in the Israeli press. And what made it even more transparent was that it was replaying a script from 1982 after the Camp David agreements, in which Israel and the United States accepted Sadat's 1971 offer. They had to evacuate Yamit, the city they'd built on the in occupied Sinai and the other settlements. So a big national trauma was staged. Could have done it exactly this way, but they made it look like a huge trauma. And in fact, there was a headline in Haaretz, the main newspaper, which said, National Trauma 82. Okay, that was the game played for the benefit of the Goyim, out there. Back in 82, they redid it in 2005 with Gaza. And they said it pretty frankly. They said, look, this is just a way of settling the West Bank. Immediately after the so-called withdrawal, which kept Gaza totally under control, incidentally, shortly after that, Palestinians really committed a major crime. There was a free election, only free election in the Arab world, carefully monitored. Everyone agreed it was free and fair, January 2006. The vote came out the wrong way. The U.S. attitude towards elections is extremely clear. If they come out the right way, we hail them as a triumph of democracy. If we come out the wrong way, we overthrow the government, we invade, we sanction, you know, and so on, which is exactly what happened. The vote came out the wrong way. Instantly, within days, the United States and Israel instituted harsh sanctions. Europe went along, more or less, not quite that harsh. A couple of months later, the U.S. and Israel decided to try to overthrow the government with a military coup. So they organized a military coup in Gaza, run by Fatah, strongman, Mohammed Dahlan. The coup was beaten back. The elected government, Hamas, beat back the coup and took power. They're not nice people, incidentally. They run Gaza quite brutally. I don't like them at all, but they were the elected government, whatever you think. They beat back the military coup, and that is a real crime. At that point, the U.S. and Israel imposed a very harsh siege, extremely harsh. But Gaza is barely livable by land, by sea, of course, by air. Fishermen are driven toward the shore so they can't fish. It's very harsh. And that was the punishment for first electing the wrong people and secondly beating back a military coup intended to overthrow the government. We go up to 2008, and something quite interesting happened. And there was rocket fire in both directions. Most of it comes from Israel. In fact, by June 2005, 2006, I think about 8,000 shells, Israeli shells, hit Gaza. This, you know, the proportions are proportional to the power, naturally. But there was Hamas rocket fire. In June 2008, a ceasefire agreement was reached between Hamas and Israel. Israel didn't live up to the ceasefire. Its commitment was to end the siege. They didn't do that. But Hamas did live up to the ceasefire. We have that from official Israeli authorities. You look up the official Israeli website, government website, it says, yeah, there was no rocket fire. After the agreement, until November of 2008. In that month, Israel invaded Gaza, killed half a dozen Hamas militants. Hamas rockets followed, many more Israeli rockets. There were casualties all on the Palestinian side. In December, Hamas offered to reinstitute the ceasefire. The Israeli cabinet considered it and rejected it. They preferred to use violence, and they invaded Gaza. Now, that's the December 2008, January 2009 invasion, which was quite brutal and destructive. In the West, that's almost universally regarded as a legitimate act of self-defense, which was disproportionate. Even the human rights groups say that, Goldstone Report and so on. That's totally false. Israel, of course, has a right of self-defense, but the issue is, does it have the right of self-defense by force? That's always the issue. Everyone has a right of self-defense. It doesn't justify violence, even in criminal law or international law. Do they have a right to use violence in self-defense? Answer, certainly not, because there were peaceful means, and they knew there were peaceful means. They could simply reinstitute the ceasefire, ends the rockets, just as it had done before. But the U.S. and Israel preferred to attack, and given their ideological power, they could establish that as the framework for interpretation. Then comes, it continues until today. I mean, it essentially just, you know, by now there's some relaxation of the bitter siege, but still the supplies going into Gaza are about a third of the level of what they were before the 2007 siege was instituted, barely enough to keep people alive. And I should say that in the area of the West Bank that Israel completely controls, Area C, about 60% of the West Bank, in that area, living conditions are even worse than Gaza. Not pretty. Well, that's basically where we stand now. Going back to options, we have two. One option is moving toward the international settlement. The other realistic alternative is that the U.S. and Israel will continue doing exactly what they're doing, basically what I described in Gaza, the West Bank, and there could be some small Palestinian entity established somewhere would have certainly not meet even minimal conditions for a decent survival. It would survive maybe at the as long as the European Union is willing to pour money into it, so that around Ramallah, you know, people can live quite well, elegant restaurants, theaters, and so on, like any third world colony. Those are the real options. Now, what does that leave for us? Well, final word. There's a lot of discussion in recent years about the analogy between Israel and South Africa. Much of that discussion, I think, is quite dubious. So, for example, within Israel itself, there is discrimination, but it's not apartheid. Actually, it's much more like what we've been familiar with here for centuries. And I even experienced myself years ago, a little worse, but like that, and common around the world, unfortunately. Within the occupied territories, it's much worse than apartheid. It's not apartheid. Ariel Sharon described the cantons being left to the Palestinians as banter stands, but that was unrealistic. The South Africa needed the black population. That was their workforce. It's 85% of the population. That's the productive workforce. So therefore, they had to take care of them. And just like slave owners had to take care of slaves. They couldn't let them die. That's their capital investment. So South Africa, in fact, provided some benefits to the Bantustans. Israel, in contrast, does not want the Palestinians. They're happy to have them go. And back in 1967, Moshe Dayan, who again was one of the more sympathetic of the leaders towards the Palestinians, he explained to the cabinet, to his associates, his proposals. He was in charge of the West Bank. He said, we have to tell the Palestinians in the West Bank that we have no solution for them. They're going to live like dogs, and those who want to leave can leave. And we'll see where that goes. You know, that's the proposal, and that's what's being implemented. That wasn't true in South Africa. They needed the black population. So the analogy to apartheid is completely inaccurate, I think, in both areas. But it's worse than apartheid in the occupied territories. It's not as bad in Israel itself. However, there is an analogy which is significant and which isn't much discussed, but which tells us, I think, what we ought to do. Back in 1960, South African nationalists, white South Africans, recognized that they were becoming an international pariah. A lot of opposition to apartheid was developing. There was a big massacre, there was a lot of protests, and so on. At that point, the South African foreign minister called in the American ambassador and told him, look, we know we're becoming an international pariah. Everyone's voting against us in the UN and so on. But you and I both know that there's only one vote in the United Nations, yours. The rest doesn't matter, which happens to be pretty accurate. And in fact, history played out just the way he predicted. Through the 60s and the 70s, opposition to apartheid increased. There were sanctions, there were pressures. Finally, the UN passed sanctions in the 1980s. Congress was passing sanctions. The US government continued to support South Africa. Reagan had to evade even congressional sanctions to increase support for South Africa. Both South African violence, repression internal to the country, but also South Africa's attacks in the neighboring states, Angola and Mozambique, which were no small business. They killed over 1 million people in those two countries. U.S. continued to support it. As late as 1988, Washington condemned the African National Congress, Mandela's ANC, condemned it as one of the more notorious terrorist groups in the world. In fact, Mandela just was taken off the terrorist list 2 years ago. Now, for the first time, he can come to the United States without a special dispensation. So this is part of the famous war on terror. They're a terrorist group. We have to support white South Africa, no matter what the UN says, no matter what Congress says. And that continued. And by the late 80s, South Africa looked impregnable. They'd won everything. They were getting everything they wanted. They were very triumphant. Within the next 2 years, U.S. policy shifted. And a couple of Mandela was let out of Robben's Island. A couple of years later, apartheid collapsed. It's not pretty, not at all. In fact, in many ways, it's worse than under apartheid for much of the population. But it was nevertheless a major victory for justice to get rid of this horrendous system. And it turned on one point. What would the Godfather decide? As soon as the U.S. decided they'll join the world, apartheid collapsed. And I think that something similar holds in this case. If Washington's position shifts, if the U.S. joins the world, there is a short-term settlement, which is much better than what exists now. My own hope would be, and I think David would probably feel the same way, that if I read it correctly, that if the cycle of violence declines, if there is a formal political settlement, if the occupation ends, then other processes will begin to take place. Anyone who's ever been in that area knows that to draw a line through the area west of Jordan makes absolutely no sense. It just can't be done. And I suppose that commercial and cultural and other relations will develop, and it might move towards what, at least in my view, is a more sensible, longer-term settlement. But that's for the future. What's on the table right now is which choice are we going to make? The occupation, with exactly the way I described, or a political settlement, as has been the international consensus for 35 years. Okay, I'll stop there.